Welcome, bold travellers, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vandervelde, and this week you join us in the Worst Foot Forward garden, as after a complete misunderstanding, we're attempting to knock out 32 round robins. However, before the RSPB shut us down, I should probably just get right on with it and introduce my humble opponent for this week's competition. He is the friend to my foe, the plucky away team to my overbearing home team, and the skins to my dress shirt. It's Barry McStay.
Oh, thanks, mate. Have you ever won any competitions or tournaments?
No, the only two competitions I can think of, like proper knockout tournaments that I've entered, was the chess competition at my school when I was 8, where I think I went careering out in the first round, and playing table tennis for my county when I regularly choked like Tim Henman in a semi-final.
I played table tennis for my county. It sounds funny. I know it's a statement of fact, but it sounds like it's a bit.
I swear to God, it's not a bit. It's something that I am pathetically proud of because, as I've probably said before on this show, it is the only sport where I'm good enough to be cocky against most people I play against. With irritating regularity, I would get one set up, then the nerves would get to me and I'd fall to bits, and I'm so angry at myself that is the reality of my sporting psychology.
I was in chess tournaments as well, the clock and everything. And you know, I'd be all right against the first couple of people and win them. Then the team from this one school in Dublin who actually genuinely properly like coached their players would come along and knock you out in a couple of minutes, and then be like, next. hitting the clock, and it would go ding like a reception bell in a hotel and bring in the next competitor. But shall I introduce our guest, who's definitely a little bit higher class than both of us?
I think so.
Yeah, our guest this week is a British explorer, navigator and cartographer, captain of the British Royal Navy. And I know how much that really annoys him. Sorry, not that one. Our guest this week is an award-winning stand-up comedian, author and board gamer. He's a former radio presenter on 3 radio stations that no longer exist. And during that time, he appeared on stage with A-ha and was a guest judge on the arena tour of Dancing on Ice in front of 10,000 people, which must have scared the living daylights out of him. He has toured with the likes of Gary Delaney and Paul Sinha and been described by the Birmingham Mail as a top-class comic and by the Birmingham Metro as the future Frank Skinner. Hopefully when Frank is touring to Birmingham, he reads the Mail rather than the Metro, otherwise he's about to discover he hasn't even been born yet. Our guest is also the author of 101 Board Games to Play Before You Die, is a former UK board game champion, and on his YouTube channel, hosts Board Game Smackdown, where he pits various comedian guests against one another in a funnier version of those awkward family Christmases where, after a couple of sherries, Auntie Jean finally divorces Uncle Ray because he couldn't name the actor who played Bobby Ewing in Dallas to get hold of that pink wedge of cheese in the battered old 1980s edition of Trivial Pursuit. Bringing his unique insights into our own regular pursuit of trivia is the very game, and definitely not the explorer, James Cook.
Hey, everybody.
During that, I saw you holding up your trophy. Is that a Carcassonne trophy?
Yeah, because you were talking about if you've ever been in a tournament. I often take part in the UK Carcassonne tournament at the UK Games Expo. And in 2015, I won it.
Wow.
And had to go to Germany to represent the UK in the World Carcassonne Championship. And this is my certificate from the World Championships, where I came in 25th place.
Out of how many competitors?
7 billion.
I have been to the actual city of Carcassonne because my godfather was born there.
Was he born in a monastery, a small church, a cathedral?
Does he lie down in fields?
You know, he was standing up inside the city walls, and but wasn't one with a pennant inside it, sadly. And already this podcast has gotten far too niche for the majority of our listeners. For anyone who doesn't know the game Carcassonne, it's a tile laying game. There's lots of different designs on the tiles. So is there a sort of an element that you could get in like card games where are you counting the tiles?
Yeah, I know how many of each tile there are in the game. So I know there are 6 monasteries and that 2 of them also have roads in. Yeah. So I can see when they're coming out. And you can use that knowledge to basically block your opponents. And that's really the difference between playing it seriously and then playing it you know, with your family. Will you play with your family? Yeah. Will you play it for fun? And you just stop everyone from having fun by making sure they can't play anymore.
That's what I've discovered about when you play anything to a high level. Or, you know, when I've had to up my Scrabble game since I met my wife. Because she plays to win, which means making sure that you don't. And playing lots of niggly little 2 and 3 letter words to stop you doing anything big and grand.
Yeah, which I think in a friendly game of Scrabble kind of is against the spirit of the game. I think you should be able to say what the words mean or prove that you use them in everyday language. Not that you've just memorized all the 2 letter words in the book.
Yeah. I broadly agree. I feel if I was to describe playing Scrabble against my wife, it would like be being slowly squeezed by an intellectual vice, which I'll let you know, not my fetish.
All right, Ben, we're not here to kink shame.
Yeah. Kink's a good one for Scrabble. 2 Ks, that's a decent score.
Yeah.
James, we've discovered that you're very good at being the best at Carcassonne in the UK. Yeah. What are you the worst at in the world?
7 years ago.
7 years ago, yeah.
7 years. The last time I entered the tournament, I was beaten in the knocked out by an 18-year-old, so yeah.
The younger, the quicker brains.
It's a young man's game, or woman's, or anything in between. What am I worst at? Probably self-promotion. I don't tell anyone that I'm doing anything ever. That's probably bad. That's put a massive kibosh on my, what I laughably refer to as my career, because I'd rather die penniless in a pauper's prison than show anyone anything I've been working on.
To be fair, when I went to James's website, you scroll down it and it says, hopefully I'll put stuff about all these things onto this site, but I am easily destroyed. Which I think is a good summary.
I like that your hero for stand-up appears to be the protagonist in a Charles Dickens novel.
The penniless pauper type.
Yes.
Yeah. There's probably a board game called Penniless Paupers.
Probably.
Yes, available for $69.99 from Hawk's Nest. This week, as we are three competitive spirits, we're talking about the world's worst tournament. And Barry, you're going to go first.
I am indeed. Now, I know Ben is going to probably chat a little bit about medieval tournaments and things like that. But I did read briefly about where the word tournament comes from. It's from the French verb tournoyer, or from the Latin tornare, to turn. In this instance, it means sort of to joust or to tilt at people. A joste means to approach or to meet. I read a bit about interesting tournaments from around the world before I tell you a couple of good stories, though. Finland, we've talked about Finland in the area of competition before. They've given us the wife-carrying championships. They've given us the air guitar championships. And they're also the home of the cell phone-throwing championship.
Now, is that former Nokia employees?
I don't know. Actually, to be fair, they should sponsor it, shouldn't they? Maybe they do, because the prize for the winner of this is a new mobile phone. Every year since 2000, they've had this tournament in Savonlinna in Finland. Got to try and throw them the longest distances and also the best technique. And the phones are provided or donated. They're all broken phones. And they're keen to point out they're all responsibly recycled afterwards as well.
Is that the tournament that Naomi Campbell won?
She won the female section. I think Russell Crowe won the men's.
Yeah. Right.
Are you really a global superstar if you haven't thrown a mobile phone and been in TMZ for it? I also read about the World Worm Charming Championships, hosted by Williston Country Primary School in Williston, in England, held every year on a Saturday in June, and participants from all over the world come and they try and charm worms. And it's basically they try to coax worms to rise to the surface. Championship dates back to 1980, apparently. They've all sorts of different techniques. They call themselves wormers, apparently. You get given a little square metre of a field, and you've got to get as many worms to the surface as you can in under 15 minutes.
What I liked about that is I thought you were going to say it dates back to the 16th century or something.
Yeah.
No, 1980.
Yeah, it was the height of the Cold War. Just,
yeah. Well, Everyone was pogoing to punk anyway, and they thought, well, this is a great way to get worms out of the ground.
Yeah. And another international tournament to like sort of similar country vibes is the Pumpkin Chunkin' Competition. It's an annual event for chucking pumpkins as far as possible.
With your, is that shot put style or with a catapult?
There are various, apparently, categories. The farthest distances are using catapults and slingshots, trebuchets, centrifugal chuckers, and other machines. And they've got a very big following, apparently. The Guinness World Record shot is held by a pneumatic cannon dubbed Big 10 Inch at 5,545 feet, which is over it's nearly 1,700 metres.
Okay, I now want to see the Olympic javelin throwing replaced by pneumatic cannons and held between two different stadiums. So you have to fire the javelin out of one stadium and try to land it in a target in the other.
Yeah, a kilometre and a half away, yeah.
Yes.
Because they could do that in Nottingham. They could go from the City Ground to Meadow Lane.
Yeah.
They could do it at Anfield to Goodison Park as well.
Yeah, or absolutely.
Dundee United to Dundee. They're closely.
I don't know why it doesn't catch on over here. Yeah, apparently there is a rule that the pumpkin has to remain intact while it's airborne. If it leaves the barrel or the sling or whatever and it's already broken up, it's referred to as pie, as in pie in the sky.
Oh, very good.
Unsurprisingly, the event was cancelled in 2013 after a myriad of legal issues and injuries.
I don't know how I feel about them having machines throwing the pumpkins. That'd be like if the Brockworth cheese rolling, you were allowed to drive your car down.
Yeah. I read a little bit about computer game tournaments and things like that. Esports, obviously very popular. I didn't realise, of course, that they were quite an old event in the timeline of computers. There was a Space Invaders Championship held by Atari in 1980, and apparently 10,000 people took part in it.
Even though there was worm stomping going on at the same time.
I can't understand how the worm stomping didn't become the global event. And there was events sponsored by Twin Galaxies to find the greatest video game masters in North America. Activision promoted a thing in the 1980s. Activision basically invented achievements you get in computer games these days by they invited players to complete certain challenges in their games. And if you did, you could take a photograph of your television and post that photograph to Activision and they would post back to you a patch you could sew onto a jacket or a jumper or something with your achievement on it.
So what, that's like the computer games equivalent of your 25-metre swim badge?
Yeah, well, you know, nowadays you play a computer game and it's sort of a pop-up to say, oh, scored 10 goals in one match or something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, apparently these patches, you can still find a lot of them on eBay and as people are still completing some of these challenges on their old Activision games. I really liked reading about another one of Atari's endeavours. So I mentioned the Space Invaders tournament, 10,000 people taking part in 1980. So they tried to ramp it up the next year with the Atari $50,000 World Championships in Chicago, 1981. And it was part of the Tournament Games Spectacular $400,000 weekend, which is going to feature all sorts of events like 8-ball, air hockey, foosball, and foosball is the crucial one. Because the tournament was organised by a company called Tournament Games Inc., or TGI, which was run by a chap called Lee Peppard. And Peppard had a big hand in popularising foosball in America in the 1970s. He helped drive it into absolutely stratospheric popularity. His company were making 1,500 foosball tables a week. And so he had run a lot of foosball tournaments. They'd done very well. A handful of top players were able to make a living in foosball tournaments. And then video games came along and foosball kind of began to wane slightly. And Peppard was beginning to run low on cash. And so when Atari approached him asking would he mind helping them run this video game tournament, he's like, yeah, great, good. I could sort of ease into that side of the market that's eaten up the foosball market. Atari gave him $40,000 in advance and a verbal agreement to finance the venture. And obviously, they'd had 10,000 people at a Space Invaders tournament the year before, so they thought they were going to make loads of money from the entry fees and all sorts this year. They spent $100,000 promoting the event. There were some issues in the lead-up. Atari backed out of their commitment. They had to renegotiate the contract. Peppard was undergoing legal issues, but he hoped he'd be able to recoup his losses from the entry fees, as I said, until he saw the turnout, which ended up with 138 entrants for the competition, which would have exactly one game, the arcade version of Centipede. Not only were they only playing one game, the arcade version of Centipede, they would only be playing it for 3 minutes at a time, and they had to bring their own coins to operate the machines. The competitors had to pay their own travel and their accommodation, a $60 entry fee, a $1 officiating fee. It was a complete catastrophe. Nobody was interested in playing Centipede when there were all these other games they could have played. And eventually, after being told they had to get the highest score possible in an allotted time, no one's quite sure how much the allotted time was, they would sort of advance a certain number of players to the next round of the competition. 2 hours passed, and then eventually the people who were judging it said, "You've all qualified, because none of us have really been paying any attention."
It's basically $61 to go to the world's worst arcade.
Yeah, and yeah. then pay with your quarters and everything else.
And then be given a participation trophy.
Yeah, well, the Peppard was cornered by players and it says here, and their parents. And he said, obviously, apparently he'd given them all, they'd been given initials that they were meant to enter into the scoreboards thing so they could keep track of things, and people were using their own initials. It was really badly organised. Peppard promised that he would meet everyone the next morning to explain things and then excused himself to go to a cocktail party.
That's a baller move, that is.
It really is. Excuse me, I've got some Manhattans to drink. The winner of the man's competition was Eric Jinner, who won $12,000, and Ok Su Han won the women's competition. She won $4,000, or one-third of the man's prize, because the 80s. Unsurprisingly, both the checks bounced.
No, actually, they won the same amount.
Yeah, yeah, to be fair.
If anything, it was incredibly progressive.
Yes. The financial fallout of it led to Atari losing loads of money as they had to foot the entire bill themselves. Peppard's company went out of business and he lost his home. And that was going to be my choice for the World's Worst Tournament until I found this. In the early 1980s, the editor of Golf Digest magazine, Peter Andrews, came up with an idea. He wanted to find the world's worst golfer. But he didn't just want to find the worst golfer, because he could just, you know, get a tiny child who's never played golf before, give them golf clubs that are too big for them, they'd obviously be terrible. This golfer had to be an avid golfer. They had to be passionate about the game, but still be terrible. They had to play at least 21 rounds a year, be aged between 35 and 55, be in good physical health, and carry at least a 36 handicap. That means if you're playing an 18-hole round of golf, you're getting a couple of shots free per hole. And they also specified no whiners. They wanted people to be nice. So they received 627 nominations in letter format. One entrant was a man in Pennsylvania who had a teaching professional refund his money after one lesson because he said he was unteachable. One nominee had a handicap of 76. And another entrant was an army guy stationed in Germany who played four games with people who had never played before and lost all four of them. In the end, they picked four competitors from all of those letters who would compete against one another for the title of the worst avid golfer. They were Jack Pulford, a restaurant owner, Joel Mosser, a stockbroker, Kelly Ireland, an attorney, and Angelo Spagnolo, a grocer from Fayette City, Pennsylvania. And they thought, what's the best place we test these people? We're going to make them play one another on one of the hardest golf courses that the professionals play on the US PGA Tour, the TPC at Sawgrass.
This is bullying, Barry.
It's brilliant. Not only that, not only are we making them play at the TPC at Sawgrass, if people don't know this golf course, it's quite narrow fairways, lots of trees, lots of bunkers, and a lot of water, more on that in a minute. They were going to play it from the back tees. So when the professionals play an event, they play from the very farthest back of the hole. If you're playing, you know, casually, you tend to be a couple of tees further forward. So they came out to Ponte Vedra in Florida in 1986 for a practice round and then played the match the following day, followed by PGA Tour referees to make sure they're following all the rules, TV crews and scorers to keep count of their score. After 7 hours of play, and now a round of golf should take about four, 12 dozen golf balls lost and 25 range balls lost because they had to dip into some of the balls from the driving range.
I think you're going to say that three of the four ball had gone missing and a search party had to be sent out.
They had registered no pars between them. The best score was a couple of fives and some par threes. So a couple of double bogeys were the best that anyone could manage. Kelly Ireland was the winner. The four of them, he actually had the lowest score, 197, which is roughly 2.5 times as many shots as it should take to get around that golf course. Angelo Spagnolo came last of the four of them, and he took 257 shots, largely down to the fact that he scored a 66 on a single hole.
Were they playing incredibly strict tournament rules that, you know, if you swing and a miss, that's a shot?
He was playing that, but it wasn't just that was the reason. The 17th hole at Sawgrass is a very famous golf hole. Some people may have seen photos of it before. It is an island green on a par 3. You stand on one side of a lake. There is an island, which is the green in the middle of the lake. And there is a little sliver of green where you walk out from the edge of the lake to the green itself. So you're hitting over this mass of water, and he scored 66 on that particular hole. He eventually, after 30 minutes of trying to get it over the water, had his caddy suggest maybe he should stop trying to go over the water and just chip it around the edge of the lake and then put it along that little path onto the green. And he still managed to put it into the water at one point. They have now renamed that sliver of earth Angelo's Alley. His 66 on that hole was the same score that the winner of the Players' Championship, the professional event that took place on that golf course the previous year, shot in his entire final round for the entire 18 holes. And my favourite little coda to this is that Angelo came back to TPC Sawgrass 25 years later in 2011 at the invitation of the Golf Channel to see if he could improve his score. And the video is adorable. The former commissioner of the PGA Tour, who was there for the original competition, is there sitting at the back of the green to watch him. And he made it onto the green this time in 11 shots. Only to be told by a rules official he had incorrectly moved his ball from a divot he'd made and would have to take a 2-stroke penalty, go back over the water and try and get it onto the green again. And he took a further 30 shots to get it onto the green, scoring a 44. Afterwards, the PGA reviewed the footage and determined he'd actually been given an incorrect ruling and he should have been able to continue playing from where it lay after 11.
Oh.
Angelo hates that hole, but he did say at the end of it, it still beats going to work even though I can't play golf. And he and the other worst avid golfers still meet up every now and again, play against one another, raising money for charity. Angelo hosts his own golf tournaments and he's raised over $1 million to fight multiple sclerosis.
Oh, that is lovely. Are there any jobs worth pedants worse in the world than the administrators of golf tournaments?
Yeah, that guy who came over and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Spagnolo, but there was a rules infraction."
Oh, they love it, don't they? Just there, just going, "I'm terribly sorry. I know that you've just hit the round of your life, but you sneezed illegally on the 15th tee."
When he was walking over to take his ball back from the green to replace it after that penalty, he did mutter under his breath something about throwing himself into the lake.
Oh, no.
I'm a World Cup nerd. That's just shorthand for FIFA Men's World Cups, by the way. I will occasionally just refer to it as the World Cup. Sorry about that. And I've been researching basically every FIFA Men's World Cup since they started in 1930. So I am putting forward what I believe to be the worst FIFA Men's World Cup, which is the one held in Italy in 1934.
I mean, this is interesting, but also I feel like we may have to reappraise anything you put forward after Christmas 2022.
Well, yes, indeed. Some of the things that happened in 1934 are echoed in what is happening in 2022. For example, 1934, Italy, I don't know if you're aware the state of the Italian government at that time.
Silvio Berlusconi was just entering his third term as an MP.
It was Mussolini was the president of Italy. They're part of the fascist party, unashamedly fascists. And you might be thinking, okay, well, maybe they awarded them the World Cup and then Italy became fascist after that. No, they awarded them the World Cup in 1932, 10 years into Mussolini's reign. They knew what they were getting.
Yeah.
The other country who wanted to host the 1934 World Cup was Sweden. When FIFA held a vote in the 20s to decide whether they were going to start doing World Cups as World Championships, Sweden said, no. we don't think you should. And then they went, we are doing it. And they were like, oh, can we host it? And they were like, no.
So you don't believe in it.
They just went, no, Italy's going to have it. Italy pledged to spend 3.5 million lira on the finals, which is about £2.50. The format is one of two World Cups that just went into a straight knockout format. There are no groups. And as a World Cup fan, the groups are one of the things I love about the World Cup, because it's kind of little, it's like a little warm up.
But also means that if people have been travelling for, you know, if you come from all around the world, you're not coming for a single match and then fuck off home again.
Yeah, exactly. And in 1934, when it took 3 weeks to get from Europe to South America and vice versa, that was a thing. In fact, in 1930, only four European teams entered the World Cup in Uruguay, just because it was so far away. And to get them to go, the Uruguayans basically had to say, we will pay for you to come.
Oh, lovely. So it's the opposite of a bringer.
Yeah. So Uruguay won the 1930 World Cup in Uruguay. And then they go, all right, 1934 is going to be in Italy. And Uruguay, the holders say, we're not going. We're not going because none of you lot would come to our party. So we're not coming to your party. All right. And Italy didn't offer to pay for them to go. So it's the only instance where the holders have not been there to sort of defend their title. The only two South American teams who make the journey are Brazil and Argentina, who both send B teams. Of the 37 players in their combined squads, 30 have never played international football. So they go all the way to Italy and they're both beaten in the first round. Which is better than what happens to Mexico, who, as far as they're aware, have qualified for the World Cup. They've won the what would later be called CONCACAF area by beating Cuba. And they go to Italy, and then they're told, by the way, the United States want to enter. You now have to play them before the World Cup starts. So this is 4 days before the World Cup starts.
What?
And all the games in the first round of the World Cup are being played simultaneously as well.
Yeah.
So it's four days before the start of the World Cup. Mexico are told, you have to play the United States, who are here. And Mexico get beat 4-2 in Rome. So they travelled all the way and then had to leave, not even being part of the World Cup.
That is tremendous.
So good. Oh, Ireland haven't qualified for Qatar 2022. I wonder if we should just show up in November and say, oh, by the way, Netherlands, you've got to play us if you want to take part. We've decided we want to enter.
I'm going to level with you. When it comes to my bit, we're going to talk about various chivalric tournaments, one of which is the Pas d'Armes, where basically some knights would pitch up at a bridge and go, you want to get past? You've got to beat me first. That sounds exactly like what you're proposing Ireland do. They just they hang out for a game of foosball in the avenue on the way to the stadium.
Yeah.
USA then are drawn against Italy in the first round and lose 7-1.
Good.
And the only other non-European team in the tournament are Egypt, who are the first African team to ever qualify for a World Cup. And they also lose in the first round.
Oh, no.
Because they're drawn to play against Hungary, who are like a really good team at that time. Although they do score two goals. They lose 4-2. And their manager was Scottish. Called James McRae, who was born in Paisley. He was very much the first Scottish man to be thrown out of the World Cup in the first round.
Establishing a noble tradition.
Yeah. Barry, as an Irish football fan, there is no way that you can...
Mate, we've gotten out of our groups in our World Cups.
Yes, it just took you a while to get to the actual World Cup in the first place.
There was no point showing up if you're going to get knocked out in the first round. Like the idiots from Scotland.
I am really enjoying this Celt-on-Celt violence.
By the way, the USA team at the 1930 World Cup had got to the semi-final. But that USA team that finished third was also managed by a Scot, and it had, I think, seven Scottish-born players in it. So the USA 1930 World Cup team is the most successful Scotland side. Elmer Schroeder, who was the coach of the US team, died in 1953 when he was killed by a window blind.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but that is...
You shouldn't laugh, but it is like something at a Spinal Tap, so that's fine.
All right, so I guess the curse that the Mexican team put on them carries on to this day.
The ultimate fate of a lot of the squad players in the 1934 World Cup, as you can imagine, is tied up with the happenings of World War II. The Dutch goalkeeper, Gajus van der Meulen, in 1935, opened a paediatric clinic. He was a paediatric doctor. He also, in that year, decided to join the Nazi party and openly support compulsory sterilization. So, as you can imagine, that clinic didn't last. When the Nazis invaded, he joined the SS, and after liberation was arrested and sentenced to 8 years for collaboration. But he was pardoned in 1949. He opened a new clinic, but the only people who'd come to his clinic were also former Nazis who were being shunned by society.
A very small niche in the market you're catering for there, isn't it?
Children of Nazis. I've got some of the names of players in the 1934 World Cup. I put together an 11 of players with funny names, basically.
Great. Absolutely what I'm here for.
In goal, got the Argentinian Angel Gripper.
Yes!
At the back, the Austrian Willibald Schmaus.
That's okay. Willibald Schmaus is definitely Danger Mouse who's gone through Google Translate.
Belgian Philibert Smellinks, who could smell links. Teenage boys were around in 1934. There you go. The Dutch player Jan van Diepenbeek.
No, he isn't. He was Dawson in Dawson's Creek, wasn't he?
and of course the German Willy Bush. In midfield, I got three Dutch players in midfield. Kick Smith.
So, honey, he is literally a kicksmith.
Yeah,
which is the medieval name for footballers.
Yeah,
but also Puck Van Heel and
part-time hockey player as well as footballer.
And Henk Pelican.
No.
I
refuse to engage with this.
No, this is a genuine Dutch footballer of the 1930s, Henk Pelican. the midfield is rounded off by the Belgian midfielder, Désiré Bourgeois.
That's good.
Lovely, playing with a smoking jacket, cravat and pipe.
Yeah, he was the first player to ever play entirely from a chaise longue. Up front, the Swede Gösta Dunker and the American Walter Dick.
Yes, we've got Dick and Bush.
Now, and this is all fine, and there are things there that I take objection to. But what tips it over into being the worst World Cup of all time is that, you know, these things, they're supposed to be fair. Well, now, obviously, there's been a lot of unfair decisions in the history of the World Cup, and a bit of controversy is part of it. But 1934 was essentially the most rigged of any World Cup. And they've really tried to rig them. for example, 1954, West Germany surprisingly beat Hungary in the final, having lost to them 8-3 in the groups. It later transpires that a bunch of the West Germans had traces of speed in their drugs tests.
Which players? If you don't want the goalkeeper to have speed. refuses to say on his line.
The 2013 report that said this does not name the specific players. Okay. A number of them had speed.
A number.
João Havelange, who was head of FIFA for a time, claimed that the 1966 and 1974 World Cups were rigged in favour of the home teams, although he couldn't really put forward any evidence for it other than his native Brazil didn't win them. In 1978, when the World Cup was under a military junta in Argentina, they needed to beat Peru by 4 goals to get to the World Cup final in a game they won 6-0. And it just so happens the Peruvian goalkeeper in that game was born in Argentina.
Oh, wow.
And also it's something like Argentina had scored like 5 goals in 6 games before that, and Peru had had a similarly tight defence. It's like that's the bit that makes it really smell.
There are lots of rumours about that game that the Peruvians were bribed or intimidated or that there was a large grain shipment and the unfreezing of Peruvian bank accounts in Argentina and dissidents being released from exile and all of this. There is no evidence for any of that. The thing about 1934 is there is no footage at all. So we don't know. What we do know is that in the quarterfinals, Italy plays Spain. It finishes 1-1 after extra time, so it's got to go to a replay. But in the first game, the Italian equaliser was initially disallowed but then the referee changes his mind.
The only time in history a referee in football has ever changed their bloody mind.
Yeah. So they play the replay the next day. So Italy make 4 changes. Spain makes 7, including changing their goalkeeper. Italy win the game 1-0. Spain have 2 goals disallowed and a blatant penalty ignored. And the guy who refereed the game, a Swiss referee called René Mercet, was then banned from refereeing ever again.
Banned from being Swiss for clearly not being neutral.
Yeah.
In the final, Italy play Czechoslovakia. Not only does the Italian manager sit next to the Czech goalkeeper's goal. What? Get back in your technical area. 5 minutes into extra time, Miazza handballs it, and the referee, Ivan Eklund, who coincidentally, the night before the game, had had a lovely meal with Mussolini, said he didn't see it. The ball breaks to Schiavio, and he scores the winner.
Of course the referee was on the side of the fascists in his black shirt.
Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest piece of evidence of all. Yeah. You know, it's really hard to prove rigging.
Yes. And,
but in a low-scoring game like football, it doesn't take much when it's 2 fairly evenly matched teams to swing the game one way or the other. A bunch of the stadiums that were being played in 1934 have problematic names. So in Turin, the games were played in the Benito Mussolini Stadium.
Sure, it's what you'd expect.
It's not called that anymore.
Good. It's called the Silvio Berlusconi Stadium.
The stadium in Rome was called the Stadio Nazionale per Enfe, which stands for the National Stadium of the National Fascist Party.
Oh, no. That's not great.
Which has big American Dodgeball Association of America. That stadium's not there anymore.
No.
By the way, Germany were in this World Cup and they had a swastika on their flag. As a, you know, an England fan, you know, I'm thinking, okay, where are we in all of this? Why aren't we part of it? Well, famously, the home nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, all pull out of FIFA in the 20s in a row over professionalism. So don't take part in any of the first 3 World Cups, despite the fact that FIFA keep asking them to be in it.
Yeah.
In fact, in 1934, they tell England and Scotland that we guarantee you a place in the World Cup finals. And England and Scotland both go, no. Like that. I mean, come on, Scotland. Imagine that. And that is not the... By the way, that's not the only time Scotland turned down a guaranteed place in the World Cup. In, I think, 1954, when they're back in FIFA, they start using the British Home Championships as a de facto qualifying group. And they say the top 2 in the group can come to the World Cup. And England win it, so they're through. And Scotland comes 2nd. But Scotland refused to take part in the World Cup because they didn't win the home championships.
We don't deserve our place.
Yeah. So let me tell you about Charles Sutcliffe of the English FA, who's right. One of the men responsible for England not going to the first 3 World Cups. He said that the World Cup was a joke and that the real World Cup was the home nation championships.
Oh, for the love of...
In much the same way that the real quiz is throwing Martin Freeman's shoes over a pub. He said, and I apologise for the language in this, he said that FIFA, having 1 member, 1 vote, was magnifying midgets.
They sound of an English upper-class twat.
Yes. Yeah. He also said, the idea of bringing foreigners to play in league football is repulsive to the clubs, offensive to British players, and a terrible confession of weakness in the management of a club. The FA, rather than sacking him immediately, went, yes, he's right, and introduced legislation the following year, which in essence banned foreign players from playing in England. Do you know when that rule was repealed?
1978.
It's the correct answer.
What?
Basically, if you were born overseas, you could only play for an English league club. I think if you'd lived here for 5 years.
Right.
Or something like that. So there were very, very few overseas-born players playing in the English league. And then 1978 happens, and all of a sudden, Arnold Muren, Ozzy Ardiles, Ricky Villa, and, you know, good football
Oh, yeah.
Hang on, though,
because famously in the 50, is it the 56 FA Cup final, you've got Bert Trautmann, who was a German prisoner of war who then went on to play for Man City.
Yeah, he'd lived here. He was resident here for more than 5 years, so that was allowed.
Oh, right, of course. Yes, I see.
Some of that period wasn't voluntary.
Yeah.
The thing about this Charles Sutcliffe guy is we could all basically have a go at writing the sort of quotes he would be saying. One of these sentences, we're like, yeah, whatever.
Basically, if you just go on Twitter, you'll see pretty much that.
At Charles Sutcliffe FA.
1,000 times an hour. It was the shortest World Cup and had the fewest games. It was only 17 games, and it was all done in a fortnight, even if you take into account the fact that there was a week off between the semi-finals and the final.
What? They have to get in and out, or they only rented Italy for like a short period of time?
I looked at world championships where there had been mucky play from the participants, and possibly my favourite one in terms of underhand tactics and toys thrown out of the pram by both sides in an incredibly petty way was the 1978 Chess World Championship.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is between Anatoly Karpov of the Soviet Union, who was the number one player in the world, and the number two player, Viktor Korchnoi, who was a defector from the Soviet regime. So as you can imagine, a spicy meatball. Because of that, they were intense rivals. Karpov was seen as a model of the Soviet new man of the late 20th century, and he was given all the possible support he could want from the Soviet state. He had a Mercedes, a chauffeur, a Moscow apartment, a country Dacha, you know, all the classic things of a humble Soviet proletarian. Korchnoi had defected to the Netherlands, and he constantly criticised the Soviet system, and of course, worst of all, he was Jewish. Imagine. The tournament took place in the Philippines, and from game one, they were both doing things that were maybe innocent, but their opponent was considering had psyched them out. So Korchnoi didn't want to be stared down by Karpov, and so he wore mirrored sunglasses. And Karpov complained that these mirrors were reflecting the light into his eyes. He also requested that his opponent's chair be examined for prohibited devices. These included, apparently, psychokinetic devices that he was worried were going to be used on him. Also, at a more asinine level, he said he was going to be distracted by his opponent swivelling round in his own chair. Now, I don't know if Korchnoi did this, but I've got lovely images of him just spinning round and round and round and round and round and round while Karpov is trying to decide his next move.
Yeah, like an 8-year-old in his mom's office.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliantly, Korchnoi then retaliated by complaining about Karpov allegedly receiving coded messages during the game. Gentlemen, what form do you think these coded messages took?
Is it to do with yogurt?
Correct, it is to do with yogurt. Members of the Soviet...
The cultures in his yogurt were so live they could actually speak to him.
Very friendly bacteria. So apparently he thought that members of his entourage were delivering different colour and flavour yogurts to signify different moves that it would be recommended that he take. So strawberry yogurt meant one move, raspberry yogurt meant another. I presume raspberry yogurt meant don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are trillions of potential moves in any game of chess at any one time. There aren't that many flavours of yoghurt.
Yeah, they're coming in increasingly inventive flavours of yoghurt. Cement and pine needle yoghurt. Like, what's that mean? Yes, the Sicilian gambit, please.
Equally as bizarre, you had a chap called Vladimir Zucker, who was a parapsychologist, and he would sit in the front row and stare malevolently at Korchnoi. And Korchnoi thought that he was either hypnotising him or attempting to interfere with his own brainwaves. And so, to counteract this, Korchnoi brought in Dada and Didi.
What, the Brazilian footballers?
Yes. No, they were two members of an Indian sect called Ananda Marga, and he said that he used the two mystics to taught him yoga and transcendental meditation. They basically hovered round the Soviet delegation and intimidated them with their woo.
Oh, they could hover. I mean, that's pretty intimidating.
Yeah. It was absolutely remarkable. But as a sporting contest, it was, you know, intense. Korchnoi went 5-2 down, brought it back to 5-5. However, he lost the final game. There is an unsubstantiated claim that if he had won, then the KGB were ready to poison him.
With yogurt.
Yes.
I remember Ski's short-lived polonium 210 flavor.
I think when we did one of our football podcasts, we talk about harpastum, which is sort of the Roman progenitor of football as we know it. It is a sport where there are 27 men on each team. It is essentially, the aim is to get the ball into your opponent's goal or end zone, but it's football mixed with martial arts, but quite wrestling predominantly, but striking and choke holds are allowed. You are no longer allowed to strike someone on the floor with your foot. And sucker punches are also now illegal. It's been featured on Netflix on a brilliant show that sort of, I think it's called Home Game or Home Team, that sort of shows different weird sports from around the globe. It's been played for many, 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 many years. Traditionally played every night between Epiphany and Lent. It was even played by Popes, Barry. I know you're a fan of a Pope.
I love a Pope.
Clement VII, Leo XI, and Urban VIII all played it.
That's a pretty mean starting lineup if you've got them across the middle.
Yeah, the papal line.
You can then play it between Epiphany and Lent.
Yes.
So if I want to play, I have to go and get like an old diary.
Yeah.
It tells me when these holidays are.
It was viewed by Henry III of France in 1574, who described it by saying, "Too small to be a real war, too cruel to be a game."
That's a great advert for it, to be fair. I'm kind of curious.
I can imagine that on the side of a board game box.
Well, yes. Barry,
that you see in a charity shop.
I'll level with you. You'd probably quite enjoy watching it because it is 54 buff, topless Italian men getting hot and sweaty and tackling each other to the ground in a sandy arena. There is...
Oh, I think I have played this game, actually.
Yeah. My main two issues with it are, interest in it waned in the early 17th century. However, by 19...
That's my main issue. It didn't appeal. Didn't appeal to the roundheads and cavaliers, so I'm out.
But it was brought back by your friend and ours, Benito Mussolini, in the 1930s. Oh, no. But now it is played only once a year. I think this is a different part of the year. It is played each year in the Piazza Santa Croce in Florence in the third week of June. And basically a team from each quadrant of the city is represented. The blues, the reds, the whites, the greens. So it's similar to what we were talking about in the World Cup group stage. You have two semi-finals where two teams play each other and then the winners go through to the final. I don't know, there's just something about all the grandiosity around that sport, and it's basically just the same four teams beating the shit out of each other over and over. If it was a tournament on like the Faroe Islands, fine, I would accept that. Basically, this game should either be the Royal Rumble meets football or a 64-team tournament, and I'm just frustrated that it's only four teams.
Yeah.
But for my worst tournaments, I looked into jousting in medieval tournaments. Now, the umbrella word for jousting, obviously umbrellas are only legal in jousting tournaments after the 1860s.
After the invention of the bicycle.
Yes. Hastelude is the generic term for all sorts of different martial games. Hasteludium was literally a lance game in Roman times. And these sort of games took place in Europe from sort of the late 12th century, having been banned by the Catholic Church, and reached their peak in early Renaissance time of the early 16th century. And then as that form of fighting became ever more archaic, it sort of faded out in the 17th, 18th century when people were like, oh, guns, let's just shoot them with guns. I'm just going to tell you just a couple of fun facts about them. Do you know who Ulrich von Lichtenstein was?
Is he invented the country of Liechtenstein?
Maybe.
Oh, he's it's a Knight's Tale.
Yeah, he is in A Knight's Tale, played wonderfully wickedly by Rufus Sewell, but he was a real guy. He was based on a real guy who was based in one of the biggest stars of jousting. And he travelled all around Europe, basically taking on all comers. But he basically, like many people, used jousting as a form of cosplay. And to sort of show off his abilities, he would often cosplay as King Arthur, but also in 1227, he dressed as Frau Venus and fought. So he dressed as the goddess of love and then fought men with his lance.
I find that very confusing, but I would like to watch it, please.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm calling it now Ulrich von Liechtenstein as an early genderqueer pioneer.
Yeah.
And there were loads of them, people who did this. A couple of centuries later, you had Antony of Luxembourg, who turned up in an elaborate costume where he entered the lists chained to a model of a black castle, and he could only be freed with a golden key and the approval of the attending ladies.
He invented the escape room.
Yeah.
But he's... Sorry, is he meant to be jousting another knight who's down the other end, like sat on a horse with a lance, charging towards him? He's going, well, I'm not allowed to charge him until someone can free me. It's like a Houdini act.
Yeah, it would seem so.
Lugging this enormous castle behind.
Yeah, some tournaments that went wrong. This is one of my favourite ones. It's quite bloodthirsty. But by the sort of 12th and 13th century, you had a lot of melee fighting, where basically every man for himself. And some tournaments, it would just be, you know, wooden swords or blunted swords, and people wouldn't be going for the kill. Others would be more involved. According to Juliet Vale, who was a writer at the time, the worst episode of this was a notorious encounter at Neuss, or Neuss, I guess, in the Holy Roman Empire on the Rhine in 1241, when at least... when at least 60 knights and squires died. However, they didn't necessarily die by being struck or punctured by weapons. They died by being suffocated to death by the dust in the tournament field. In fact, suffocation, or basically boiling in your own suit of armour, was a regular risk for many participants.
You go to these old houses and they've got these suits of armour just standing in hallways. Have they actually opened them to check that they're empty?
Yeah, no. Well, it's basically tinned goods, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's knights in brine.
First, there's a prototype of the boil in the bag meal.
Yeah.
Basically.
Knights in brine satin. another great piece of history from 1445. This is recorded by the historian Sidney Anglo, who talks about a feat, and this is an inverted commas, accomplished by Gaston de Foix. Gaston had been enjoying himself in the lists, knocking his opponents about, bending their backbones with his buffets, and generally performing wonders. His last course was against a fine jouster and rider, Philippe de Lenoncourt, whose headpiece had an unusually wide sight. Gaston's lance unerringly penetrated this, but miraculously missed Lenoncourt's face, went up into the crown of the helm, and lifted the luckless knight clean out of his saddle and over his horse's crupper, leaving him suspended in midair. There is no stranger picture conjured up in the annals of the joust than the mighty Gaston de Foix riding about the list with an armoured knight dangling from the end of his lance like a piece of washing.
Holy shit.
Lenoncourt was so bemused that he did not know whether he was in heaven or earth. And it was
bemused?
Yeah.
That's not the correct adjective.
Right. It was thought when he was carried away back to his pavilion that he was dead, how after large quantities of restorative rose water and vinegar had been thrown into his face, his heart revived. He added later...
He sat up and went, why the fuck are you doing that? Have I not suffered enough?
Yeah. My favourite thing is that at the end, the chronicler just writes, he jousted no more that day.
Not that day.
That day.
Next day.
But for my nomination of the World's Worst Tournament, we're going to talk about the pas de arm of Suero de Quinones. Now, a pas de arm, like I said earlier, is where some knights would pitch up at a bridge, like the Black Knight in Monty Python, and say, no man shall pass unless they best me in combat. And some of these pas de arm would develop into tournaments. So, In 1434, you had a chap called Suero de Quinones, who was a prominent Castilian knight, who took it upon himself to sponsor an elaborate joust. And the reason that he did this was to pay homage to a woman who he wanted to take as his wife.
It says on a Tinder profile, it says, rich fighters only.
WLTM, men with GSOH and VVBL. That's very, very big lance.
So this all began when on the first day of January 1434 at La Motta, a castle in Valladolid, where King Juan II of Castile with his wife Lady Maria.
Surely it should be King Juan the First.
Excellent. They were visited by Don Suero.
And oh, the sweary Spaniard. Evening, cunts. Yeah. It's me, Don fucking Suero.
I said Don Suero. I am King Juan and only. Go on, again. Get us all back on the horse.
And we'll try and push you off with our big sticks.
Yeah.
So he entered this room with the monarchs in without any prior notice. He came there carrying an iron choker around his neck with 9 knights with them, all accompanied in armour. And he formally requested the king's permission to carry out a vow of love that he had made to Lady Leonor of Tovar. And the vow was this, that every Thursday he would wear the iron choker to escape from his prison. And he would get such a liberation if he ended a life with an honourable passage of arms and then followed that with a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. He requested the king's permission to be placed in one of the most travelled places in the kingdom, the bridge at the Hospital de Obigo in Leon, and to block the passage of any knight who wanted to cross it. Since there were going to be so many, he basically requested that the 9 other knights would join him in defence of this to basically, you know, he could delegate the load. Basically, this would be a tribute to this woman.
Did the king go, just get her some flowers, mate?
Right, yeah, he should have done.
Just get her some flowers. Can I wear my gimp mask and my 9 buddies and I stand on this bridge?
Just being a general pain in the ass.
Yes.
But only every Thursday.
Every Thursday.
Because we're being pains in the ass somewhere else. Monday to Wednesday, and we have Friday off, so.
He basically turned it into an elaborate tournament. He wrote the own rules for it and put his personal stamp on the event by arranging a separate competition for himself and a jousting partner who fought each other according to these special rules. There was no consultation of the judges he'd hired, which meant that there was a massive argument with the judges about whether the rules could be used. And ultimately, the judges insisted on their authority and expelled Suero from his own tournament. And in response, he sent out a band to play in his support. And the judges were so unimpressed with this, they threatened to imprison the musicians.
See, this is what Ireland should do. Never mind showing up to 2022 and offering to play the Netherlands. They should just send U2 along.
Yeah.
That appears to be a separate adjunct to what went on. But Don Suero and his 9 knights said they would defend this passage until...
Can I just say, I would watch that pantomime.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they refused to budge until they broke 300 rival lancers. During the weeks prior to it, he hired carpenters and blacksmiths and squires and tailors and armourers to create stages all around them so that when any knight appeared to fight them, there would be a crowd there.
Having the stands in the stadium doesn't guarantee there's a crowd. They then cardboard cutouts and wooden cutouts of people to fill the seats.
No, I believe they did get a crowd because it was built near a local town. And there was not much else on, was there?
No, yeah. No, exactly.
68 knights from throughout Europe responded to the challenge. And from July the 10th to August the 9th, Don Suero and his 9 companions defended the bridge. On the final date, with every defender, including Don Suero, suffering from serious injuries, but without a single challenger having crossed the bridge, the judges declared him victorious and free of the burden of wearing the iron collar. So they basically went, yes, just go and propose to her.
And she said, no, you're a mentalist.
Yeah.
I wish this were the case, but straight away after they'd recovered from their wounds, they made the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. He left behind the iron collar attached to a gold chain there, and it can be seen to this day at the cathedral's museum.
It's like a church displaying a dildo on the altar. Yeah, this was the sex toy that this kinky guy liked to wear while he was fighting a load of people. And now we have it, the holy strap-on, displayed next to the... the chasuble.
So he returned to Leonor de Tovar, and she agreed to marry him. And they appeared to live happily ever after. 24 years of marriage. However, there is a wonderful asterisk to this, or two wonderful asterisks at the end of the tale. 24 years after the tournament, Don Gutierre de Cajeda, a knight who had participated and remained bitter about his defeat, challenged Don Suero to another joust in a nearby town and killed him.
His last words were, bollocks!
Yeah. Well, he has earned a place in history. There are streets named after him in León, his hometown, as well as in Madrid. Every year to this day, over one weekend, and with thousands of in attendance, the challenge at El Paso on Rosso is reenacted next to this bridge. But also, Don Suero de Quiñones is the inspiration for one of the most famous characters in all of European literature.
Is he Don Quixote?
Don Quixote.
I was going to say asterisks to go.
So our nominations for the World's Worst Tournament are Barry's of the Worst Avid Golfer Tournament, James's of Mussolini's Footballing Fascist Jamboree in 1934, and mine of Don Suero's El Fucking Paso on Orosso. I mean, spanning decades, moods, styles and sports, this is excellent. Oddly for me, I'm going to discount the fascists immediately. Because it's corrupt and morally troublesome, but the Italian football team of 1934 were very good at the sport.
They were. They won the Olympics 2 years later and the next World Cup in France in 1938.
And I think there were some landmark games and landmark teams and landmark players there, so I'm going to discount that. I love Barry so much, and I love the story. What's the name of the chap who hit a 66?
Angelo Spagnolo.
Yeah, I adore him. But I also like how ridiculous Don Suero was. But I think that mine is aristocratic folly, which, whilst fun, ultimately is irritating because it's toff's gonna toff. Where there is something beautiful about a man repeatedly hitting golf balls into a lake until his caddy goes, "Have you thought about going around, mate?" And just
I will post some of the videos from the original footage and his return to the hole. He comes across as very lovely and very much a good sport, but it is undeniably very funny.
No, I mean, he is very much a bad sport, not a good sport.
Yeah. Yes.
But I think I find that story irresistible. So I'm going to go for your World's Worst Avid Golfer Tournament.
Yay.
Before we go, it's time for our best news of the week, which we shall continue in perpetuity until the hellmouth of world news ceases. And we are going to Flanwerted Wells in Powys, where for only the third time in history, a man has beaten a horse in a man versus horse race.
So in your face, horses.
Yeah. In your stupid sideways facing face. This is trail runner Ricky Lightfoot has become only the third person to win the race since 1980. I know, nominative determinism. Yes, please.
Yeah, because we've talked about this race in the past.
Yeah.
And I think we knew there were only a couple of winners. And so this is the most recent one, and he's...
Yeah. So
he's done it.
It's a 22.5-mile course. There are 1,000 runners and 50 horses.
Each runner has a horse riding them, and each horse has a runner riding them.
Pleasingly, but not quite pleasingly enough, he did the 22.5-mile course in 2 hours, 22 minutes and 23 seconds. So close.
Oh, very good.
How much do you think the prize was?
Ooh, £22.
Love it.
Of horse meat.
Yeah. Yes, you've got to eat your opponents at the end. No, $3,500.
$3,500, that's good. What do the horses get if they win? $3,500.
Just an apple.
I've got to tell you some of the post-match chat, because it's just wonderful. The winner said, "It's great to win the event and beat the horse," he said. "I called my partner and said, I beat the horse." And she said, "You're joking." And I
So, hang on. So, something just occurred to me. Why are there 50 horses in this race? Does that mean you just have to beat a single horse?
Could horses finish in places 1 through 49 and then you come 50th ahead?
And you come 50th and you beat one horse.
Yeah,
exactly. Why is there actually 50 horses? Are they doing it in a relay?
Yeah. We should point out that Ben is curled up into a ball and is shaking back and forth, laughing at the, I believe at the phrase, "I've beaten the horse."
It's been a while since I've been rendered immobile. I'm not even finished yet.
Come on, buddy, you can do it.
He said, "I called my partner and said I beat the horse." And she said, "You're joking." And I said, "No, I did." And she was like, "Oh, my God." And then he said, "I thought I could give the horse a good race. It would be great. It would be great if I could go on to win the Grand National." "I never rode a horse in my life. I once rode a donkey at Blackpool Pleasure Beach, though." Oh, God.
Amazing.
Right. Oh, God.
I'm going to breathe into a brown paper bag while, James, you tell the listeners where they can find you and what they'll find you doing when they get there.
Well, as you know, I hate self-promotion, so I'm not going to tell you.
Fair.
But against every fibre of my being, I will tell you that myself and comedian Paul Savage are doing a podcast called The World Cup of World Cups, where we deep dive each FIFA Men's World Cup in order. The last one will go out just before World Cup 2022 starts. So they've already started going out now. I mean, obviously, we talk about the football a bit, but it's mainly about what happens to the players after and what all the controversies are. That's what we're interested in. Just look for the World Cup of World Cups from whence you obtain your podcasts.
Tremendous stuff. We're all off to Tower Bridge to let commuters know they're not allowed through unless they can get over to the other side in under 66 shots. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Ta-ra.